lecture five of the Broken Capitalism course. Now, you remember last week, I think someone asked the question, I thought it was a very interesting question. Is the material that we've been giving on price control and some of the other points, is this distinct to Austrian economics, or is it more or less generally accepted? And I answered, most of it, at any rate, is generally accepted. There are points in the Austrian analysis that I was giving it that maybe you wouldn't find as much in mainstream courses, such as the way price control can spread and become a type of socialism. In the Austrian view, fascism is a sort of type of socialism in which the government doesn't officially own all the means of production, but in effect controls everything because it's saying what all the prices and wages and so on are. So maybe you wouldn't find that so much in the non-Austrian school, but basically the explanation of shortage, what the effects of price control and causing shortages and surpluses, is very similar, if not identical, to what you'd find in mainstream, you know, classical economics. If you, before you took this course, if you've taken courses in economics, microeconomics at university, or looked at books on this, not from an Austrian point of view, you would probably be familiar with a lot of what I was saying so far in the course about effects of price control. But the subject of today's lecture, where we're talking about money, is a bit different because here we will be giving some views that are very distinctive to the Austrian school. You won't find some of these views so much in among other type schools of economics. So there's a distinctive Austrian view here that we'll be giving. Now, what I want to start off with is we want to contrast money from other goods and services. Let's say anything we buy with money, say with apples or oranges or non-physical goods, like say you're buying access to my lectures. We want to contrast money with all these other goods. In some ways, money is different. In one way in which we can see this is, we can imagine an economy without any money. Say we're in a barter economy. If you want to get something that you haven't produced yourself, you have to get it from someone else. And the normal way you'll be doing that, you could get it as someone who just give you things, but the normal way you could get something from somebody else is to make an exchange. So if I want something I haven't produced, I have to trade to get it. So supposing I wanted some apples that you have, and I said to the person with the, I said to you, well, I want some of your apples. I'll give you lectures on Austrian economics in return. You might, you very probably would say no, but if you said yes, then we could make a trade. So the reason I brought up this point about barter is, we can make a basic point about goods that we own, that there are two kinds of value that good can have. First is its direct use to me. Say if I have apples, I can eat the apples, or I can use the apples to make applesauce. I can throw apples at people I don't like. I can do all sorts of things with them. So there is the direct use of the apple, And then also there's a value how much other people want it. Because suppose I have some apples and other people want the apples, then I can get other things that I want. Say I want some oranges and you've got them, I've got the apples. So if you're willing to take apples and you're in return for giving me some of your oranges, so then one way that the apples are valuable to me is that they give me access to your oranges. So we have then for any of these goods or services, we have two kinds of value. Again, the what the value is to me, what it does for me, what satisfactions it gives me. And then the other kind of value is how much other people want it, what satisfactions it will give them, because that will enable me to get things that I want from them. Now, why is, I said, start off by saying, money is different from other goods and services. And then I went into this point about, imagine a barter economy and got that to use that to show how there are two kinds of value for goods and services, the direct value to me and the value that other people, the value in exchange, the value that other people place on the good. So how can we connect this up to show that money is different from other goods and services? Remember, that was the claim I made at the beginning of the lecture, but so far I haven't done much, if anything, to justify that. I said, well, money's different. Now, one way you might think, well, look, money, say if you took money, I took money out of my wallet, I don't have enough in my wallet, not as much as I like. Suppose I took a dollar bill out of my wallet, I could say, well, it's different because it's just a piece of paper, so it doesn't really have any value in itself. The only value it has is what I can get for it. But in a free market, we wouldn't have fiat money, money just created by the government. We would have money would be a commodity like gold and silver. So I can't use, so if I want to show money is different from other commodities, I can't just say, well, look, money is doesn't have any value in itself. The only value it has is what it's worth to that to other people, that other people are going to accept it. So that'll give it value. That isn't true in the free market because money is a commodity like gold and silver, and it has direct use as a commodity. For example, if you suppose we have a gold standard, gold can be used for jewelry or can be used, people have their teeth filled with gold. There are various things you can do with gold. So money in the free market has value for what you can, just like other goods, it has value in itself, what you can do with it, and also has value in exchange. So far I haven't done a very good job of saying how money is different from other goods. Remember, that's a claim we're trying to justify. I said every goods have these two kinds of value in direct use and value in exchange. But then I said in the free market, money has both kinds of use, just like other goods. So how does that show money is different? Well, the answer is that almost all the value of money is its exchange value. So even if money has some direct use, say like gold for jewelry, almost all the value will be its exchange value. The exchange, by exchange value, I mean if you have money, how much of other goods can you get for it? Say, I've got a dollar. What can I get in return? What kinds of goods and services can I get for a dollar? Probably not very much. You know, it reminds me the story of the 12-year-old boy who was on trial for murder, and the judge said to him, "Do you mean to tell me you killed your own grandmother for a quarter?" And he said, "Well, you know how it is, Judge. Quarter here, quarter there, it adds up." So, how much the boy be getting, what the quarter would be worth, would be dependent on what he could get for it. So we then say, well, how do we find that out? How much could you, what determines, well, you know, if a unit of money depends on what you can buy with it. So now we're going to try to find out how is that determined? What, say, today, someone earns $5,000 a year, he wouldn't be doing very well, but at one time, say in the, go back to around 1950, $5,000 a year would have been considered a quite good annual salary. You could buy a lot more with $5,000 than you could now with the same amount of money. A dollar would, you could buy more with a dollar than you could today. So what we want to do is try to look at what determines the purchasing power of money. So one way I think to approach that is to ask the question, is it true that the more units of money you have, the, for example, more dollars, the better off you are? Imagine you're earning $30,000 a year. Now, supposing your salary doubled, you're now making $60,000 a year. Would you be better off? I might say, oh, obviously you would, because you have more, you have twice as many dollars as you did before. You had $30,000 before, now you have $60,000. But if we just think about it, you see, it wouldn't necessarily be true, because it depends how much each dollar is worth. If, say, the purchasing power of money doesn't change and your salary doubles, then, of course, you are better off. But in order to determine whether getting more units of money would make you better off, we have to know how much each unit of money, say each dollar, is worth. What can you buy with a dollar? So you have to answer that before you can know whether you're better off if you have more units of money than you did before. So we then have a question about what does determine the value of a dollar? And here the answer is, it's just like other goods. The value depends on demand and supply. Say we want to know what would determine the value of oranges, it would depend on the demand for oranges and supply for oranges. So the same is true for money. The supply of money consists of a number of monetary units. Say, take all the dollars there are. That would be the supply. And that's pretty straightforward. What would the demand for money be? Is how much people want to hold money. So it's the demand for cash, is how much money do you want to hold. So that will determine what the demand for money is. So this is this cash balance view, demand for money, is one that Mises gave us in his book of Theory of Money and Credit came out originally in German in 1912. And this is one that's very important. This cash balance approach is very important in the Austrian view of money. Now, supposing people don't want to increase their holding of money. Obviously, some people do say you want to, but supposing in general people don't want to increase their holding of money. Now, here we have to avoid, I should have put this in the slide, we have to avoid a very important confusion one might fall into. You might think, well, everybody, or at least most people, want to get wealthier. They want to, people want more and more wealth, more goods and services. So is it always the case that people want to increase their wealth? But that isn't what we're talking about now. What we mean is not what, when I talk about demand for money, I'm not talking about demand to become more wealthier. It's just the demand specifically to hold money. So supposing, say, let's say you have property, say you own certain property that's worth $50,000. So if your demand to hold money increases, you might say, well, maybe I want to sell this property so I can increase my demand, my holding of money. And similarly, say people who are selling goods and services want to get money. But it's very important to realize it isn't true that whatever you get, want to get, just because you want to be wealthier, that you want to have more money. Say, supposing you were fortunate enough to be a millionaire, it wouldn't follow from that that you have a greater demand for money than, say, someone who's quite a bit less wealthy. You want to be wealthy, but it doesn't follow that you want to hold money. When we're talking about demand for money, we mean the demand to hold money. So what happens if, in general, people don't want to increase their holding of money? People are pretty satisfied with the amount of money they have. It doesn't mean that they don't want to get wealthier. It's just that they may do get wealthier. They don't particularly want to hold their wealth in the form of money. So what happens if the number of money units goes up, but people don't want to hold more money than before? The demand for money to hold money hasn't increased, the number of money units goes up, then the purchasing power of money will decrease, will get lower, and each dollar will buy less. And why is that? Well, it's just like demand and supply for any good. If demand hasn't changed, the supply increases, then the price will go down. So the price of money is the purchasing power, and that's going to decrease. So people say people don't want to increase their holding money, but there are more units of money. Each unit will buy less. Now, what can we deduce? What follows from that? That if the demand to hold money doesn't change, and there's an increased number of money units, so the purchasing power will decrease. Similarly, suppose we could have all sorts of other variations, like supposing the amount of money, let's take the reverse case, supposing the amount of money remains the same, quantity of money doesn't change, but there's an increase in the demand to hold money. People want to hold money, then the price of money will go up because we have an increase in demand that tends to push up the price. The purchasing power will go up. So then each unit of money will be worth more. So what we have then is that the dependent people's demand to hold money will, if we have a given stock of money, given amount of money, then people's demand to hold money will determine the purchasing power of money. So what follows from this is that any amount of money is sufficient to perform the services of money in the free market. Now that's somewhat unusual if you haven't heard this before. It's somewhat, perhaps a bit not what you'd expect. So let's go over it again. Is what it means is that supposing you have, let's take the total amount of money in the economy, let's say there's $1 trillion. So then that amount is enough, that quantity is enough, regardless of how people's demand to hold money changes. With a given stock of money, people can satisfy whatever demand they have to hold money, and purchasing power will adjust to changes in demand. So it's not true, as many people think, that as the economy grows, you have to have more units of money issued. There are a lot of economists will say, well, as long when the economy is growing, then you have to have at least some increase in the stock of money because people want more money to meet because the economy is growing. So you have to keep increasing the quantity of money. And that isn't true. Austrians don't view matters that way, because if people want to hold money, then that increases the demand for money, so the purchasing power of money goes up. Each unit of money will buy more. So it's not true, as many people think, that as the economy grows, more units of money have to be issued. Now, one way we could express this point, as I say, that you and that any amount of money is sufficient to fulfill the service, meet the services of money in the free market, is say any amount of money is optimal. Now, you have to be very careful if you say that, because it can be this statement can be misunderstood. And in fact, there's one well-known Austrian economist, I won't say who it is, but who has misunderstood the statement in this way, in the way I'm going to be saying. The correct reading is the one we've already discussed, which is any amount of money is sufficient. And you see why that is, because supposing, let's say, you think, well, the economy's really grown, so people want to hold a lot more money, so don't we need to have more money, units of money in existence? Maybe the government should just increase the supply of money. But that isn't necessary, because people's demand for money will cause each unit of the money to be worth more. So you don't have to keep increasing the number of units. All you have is that instead is that each unit is worth more. Now, and say that's the correct way to understand. Now, what's the incorrect way? The incorrect way, I worded this kind of in a perhaps overly abstract way, but is imagine that there's a certain amount of money around now, $1 trillion right now. So I say X is the amount of money at time T. Let's say there's $1 trillion at time T. So let's assume the demand to hold money stays the same. So there's $1 million at time T right now, $1 trillion at time T. Demand to hold money doesn't change. Then the incorrect, I emphasize the incorrect reading, is that any change in the amount of money is suboptimal. So supposing you said, well, let's increase the amount of money in the economy by 10%. So the indirect reading would be saying, well, it's that suboptimal. And you see how you might arrive at that. You might say, well, and the amount that now exists is optimal. So if you change that amount, you're going to get a suboptimal amount. And the reason that's a mistake is by optimal, all we mean here is that any amount of money will do the job. It isn't that just this amount is the best amount to do the job. It's whatever amount there is will do the job. So it's really optimal doesn't mean this amount as opposed to other amounts. It's really anything counts as optimal. Maybe it wouldn't be, maybe better not to use the word optimal because it can be confusing this way, but frequently people do use that. When Austrians say any amount of money is optimal, they have in mind particularly we don't need to increase the amount of money if there is an increase in production, because increasing in demand to hold money can be met by changing, well, be met by changing the purchasing power of each unit. You don't have to increase the number of units. But again, it isn't that the existing amount is somehow better than other amounts of money. That's one association you might have with the word optimal, but it's the wrong one to make here. Now, very often, people don't, especially those who haven't been trained in economics, they don't realize this point. Again, what is the point? They said an increase in the number of units of money doesn't by itself make people better off. It depends on the purchasing power of each unit. And if the demand to hold money hasn't changed, then increasing the supply of money, again, is just going to lower the purchasing power of each unit of money. So it isn't going to make people better off, because it isn't going to make everybody better off. We'll see how increasing supply of money can sometimes make some people better off, but it isn't going to make everybody better off, because as long as the demand to hold money doesn't change, an increase in supply of money will just lower the purchasing power of money. But many economic crank is kind of a nasty word for people who have oddball ideas on economics. They think that making money or credit more readily available will result in prosperity. So one view you find among many writers in economics will be, I found this among some so-called left libertarian, say, oh, well, look, there are these bankers who are artificially withholding credit from people, and if we can just end this banking monopoly, then this will result in more prosperity. Now, someone, Arthur, asked about Ben Bernanke, and then Leslie suggests Crankman. Well, one point Hazlitt makes is that, his work on Keynes, is that the Keynesian economics, Mises makes this point also, actually resembles, if not identical, with programs that have been advocated by so-called monetary cranks. Whether they make exactly the same arguments as the cranks is another thing, but it is a very similar policy prescription. And one example of such a crank movement is, that Hazlitt mentioned, the social credit movement. This was very influential in England in the 1930s. It was started by Major Douglas, Clifford Hugh Douglas. It was very popular in the 30s. It became influential in Canada and some other countries. If you ever, I don't know if any of you heard of a so-called A plus B theorem, that was one of the social credit people had. And they thought that you have to increase the supply of money so that workers will be able to buy back the product that they're producing. That they thought otherwise it'd be a deficit, that the economy would be producing more than people were able to purchase. So you'd have to have an increase in money, number of money units, so people could buy the product. So again, the fallacy here is to think, well, just increasing the number of units and money is going to make people better off, and it won't, increasing the number of units of money won't make everybody better off if the demand to hold money remains the same. It'll just lower the value of each unit of money. Now you might think from what I've said so far that, well, there's no point to increasing the supply of money as long as demand to hold money hasn't changed, because isn't that what I just said? I said, well, look, if the there's no increased demand to hold money, then won't the purchasing power of money will just adjust itself. So there's an increase in the quantity of money, number of money units, but demand to hold money doesn't change, so then the purchasing power of each unit will be less. So what, couldn't you argue, well, there's not going to be any real change in things, so it just means that supply of money won't have any effect at all. But you'll notice that I didn't say that. What I said was it doesn't make everybody better off. Well, I just see your question. Kevin says, can you address the myth that banks create money via loans, but do not create the money to pay the interest? Well, that would be kind of a variation of this idea. Kind of there's a shortfall in that people then have to give more and more of their assets to the bank in order to pay off the interest on the loan. But there's no reason to think that if the bank, when the bank create money, it's not creating the money that's used to pay the interest as well. I mean, it wouldn't be giving people more, it would be odd for a bank to give more and more loans to the same people so they could pay the interest on the loans, but they would be, interest would come from money that other banks had created, or money that had been created and given to other people. Again, we have to look at the specific claim here to analyze it in detail, but in general, there's no reason to accept that claim. But getting back to what I was saying, so as I want to say, I'm not saying that increasing supply of money won't have any effect at all. All I said is it's not going to make everybody better off if demand to hold money hasn't changed. And so again, we want to say, well, what would be the effects of increasing supply of money? One way we want to ask is, suppose all prices and wages instantly doubled, what would change? Well, in that case, then we have it. This would be, it's good, this is a good question to ask, because then it would be true that it wouldn't have any effect. So, because we would have then all prices have instantly doubled, but people's demand to hold money hasn't changed, so then each unit of money would just be worth half as much. I mean, it would be something like, suppose the government says, we're now going to instead of talking about a dollar bill, we're going to just call what used to be a dollar bill a $2 bill. So anything that was priced at $10 now priced at $20. Well, that isn't going to change anything. So again, if we consider this instantaneous change, that's what we need kind of to bear in mind so we can consider, will increase the supply of money have effects on anybody? So we need to take this case of instant change to be one that we can use in thinking about this question of what are the effects of increasing supply of money. I should say, just as we're mentioning this one, in the Austrian definition of inflation is an increase in money supply. And Rothbard said it's an increase in money supply beyond the increase in the supply of the monetary metal, like gold. But in any case, it's an increase in the money supply, not the price rise that often accompanies this increase in the money supply. So a lot of people say, well, inflation just means rising prices, but the Austrians don't define it that way. The inflation is the increase in the money supply. So if you said, does inflation cause rising prices, in kind of a mainstream view, that wouldn't make any sense because inflation just is rising prices. But in the Austrian view, it would make sense to ask that question because you would say, does an increase in the quantity of money, which is the inflation, cause an increase in prices? So it would make sense inflation to ask that question on the Austrian view. So again, we find that in most cases, inflation does have effects. And why is that? Well, we can see the answer to that in, if we consider this case I just gave where I said, supposing all prices, wages, so on, doubled instantaneously, then there wouldn't be any effect. So where the effects come in is that when money's increased, it doesn't change everything at the same time, doesn't change all price and wages at the same time. That's what we're discussing. That will be coming up in the next couple slides. And Cantor Jack will be discussing credit expansion also in a short time. You're both anticipating what I'm going to say. That's very good. I'm expecting great things from both of you on the quiz. So, as I say, when the state increases supply of money, the money usually doesn't get to everybody at the same time. Remember, we doubled all price and wage at the same time, it wouldn't have any effect. But what we're saying here is it doesn't go, the money increase doesn't go to everybody at the same time. Let's suppose, for example, the state increases purchases of armaments. Say the U.S. has a tremendous military budget. They want to just keep increasing this, and they finance that by printing money. So the government said, we want to buy all these new missiles, and then they print up new money. Then they give this money to the armament maker, so then the armament makers have new money to spend. And when, let's say, the armament makers spend their money, this will drive up the prices of what they spend it on, because say they've got extra money, so then that's going to increase the amount of money they're spending on different products that they buy. Then the people who get those things will have new money to spend, and then they'll spend that on things they want. And so that'll increase the prices of other goods. So we can see that price increase increases will gradually spread through the economy. Exactly like well, the armaments makers get the money first from the government, and they're going to be spending it on certain things that'll drive up the prices of those things. People who get that money will spend it on other things. But we can see as the new money spreads in the economy, prices are gradually going to go up throughout the economy as the kind of wave of spending circulates. Now, in the first stages of the spread of money, like let's take the people, the armament makers who get the money from the government, they'll have a lot of extra money, but most prices haven't risen yet. See, they've got this extra money from the government, but other people don't. So they get an advantage because they've got the extra money, but prices haven't gone up yet. So they're benefiting from the increase in supply of money because they got the extra money, but prices haven't gone up, so that's very good for them. But if you're in the later stages, they're going to find people in later stages going to find that prices have risen before they get more money because all these other people are getting the money that's driving up prices, but they haven't gotten more money yet, so they're going to lose out. So the difference here from the case we gave where everybody gets an increase in money simultaneously, where it wouldn't make any difference, is it does make a difference if the money is distributed to people in different times. The ones who get the money first will win out, and the ones who get the money much later will lose out. So inflation, even though purchasing power of money will adjust to the demand to hold money, it's still the case that some people benefit from inflation usually and others lose out by it. Now the way in which money supply spreads through the economy is, and this is the question that Arthur asked, it's called Cantillon effect. And this was named after the 18th century economist Richard Cantillon. He was born in Ireland, but spent a lot of his career in France. You can read about him in Murray Rothbard's History of Economic Thought. He thinks very highly of Cantillon, discusses him. So in the Austrian view, the relation between an increase in the money supply and price rise has to be traced in detail. What you would do in the Austrian view is you would look at the effects of an increase in supply of money on particular people and groups, having in mind this question, who gets the money first? How does it go from one person to another? Now, this view has to be contrasted with what you get in some other schools of economics. In some other schools, for example, in at least some versions of Chicago School economics, there's a formula called the equation of exchange that relates the increase in quantity of money to increases in prices. So supposing that the supply of money doubles, then you can just plug that into this formula and under certain assumptions get that prices double. Kind of a mechanical relation, just like in laws of physics. If you know you have a law of gravity and you can just fill in the masses of, say, two bodies, and you know the gravitational constant, you can figure out what the gravitational attraction is between the two bonds. So in this quantity theory view, kind of mechanical relations between increase in quantity of money, increase in price, you just have a certain formula that tells you increase supply of money, you're going to get such and such the increase in prices. But this isn't the Austrian view. It isn't that doubling the supply of money automatically should be double the prices. As I've written this in a very silly way, it is the case, of course, doubling supply of money doubles the money supply, but that's just repeating the same point. What I meant was doubling supply of money automatically doubles the price level. Please correct that. There isn't this mechanical relation. Now, we now want to deal with the point that I think Jack asked about. There's another kind of inflation that's particularly important for the business cycle. That's when we talk about booms and depression, the business cycle. Hayek didn't like, at least it sometimes didn't like, the expression business cycle. I remember he once said, a cycle implies that something is returning to the same point from which it started. And he thought the expression cycle was misleading for that reason. But regardless of his scruples on that point, people do talk about business cycles, but they don't mean it's returning to exactly where it was before. We're talking about booms and depressions. So again, here we're going to be talking about a type of analysis that's very distinct to the Austrian school. When we're talking about the Austrian view of the business cycle is not what you get in other schools of economics. So what I have in mind here, an increase in money supply, is an increase in bank credit. I say, remember, a bank doesn't print up new money, but it can increase the money supply, say, because suppose you borrow money from the bank isn't going to give you cash. It just creates an account for you, makes an entry, and say you borrowed $10,000 from the bank, you now have $10,000 in your account at the bank that you're free to spend. And the bank has created that just by making an entry into its books. It doesn't have to have cash on hand to make the loans. It just has to have a certain percentage reserves in money in making its credit expansion. So what's going to happen if the bank creates new money in this way, expands bank credit? Well, you have then, there's an increase in the amount of money available for loans. So there's an increase in supply of that. That will lower the rate of interest. Rate of interest is what you have to pay to get a loan. So just like in other goods and services, you have an increase in supply going to lower the price. So here, increase in bank credit will lower the rate of interest. So far, seems pretty simple. Now we got to the complicated part. It's not that complicated, fortunately. If it were, I wouldn't be able to explain. That's right. We're discussing fractional reserve. That's exactly right. Now, here's where the complication comes in. In the Austrian view, the rate of interest is not primarily determined, I repeat, not, N-O-T, primarily determined by demand and supply of money. So what I said so far is, well, okay, supply of money is increased, so then the money rate of interest will fall. But that's true, but in the Austrian view, that isn't what's really the most important factor in determining the rate of interest. In the Austrian view, interest is really not a monetary phenomenon. It depends on time preference. It's called time preference, which is the rate at which people prefer present satisfaction to equivalent future satisfaction. Supposing I told you, well, I've got $1,000 for you. I think, oh, isn't that wonderful? And then I say, oh, but the $1,000, you're not going to get it right now. You're going to get it 10 years from now. You wouldn't be as happy about that as you would be if you were getting $10,000 right now. People prefer satisfactions now to satisfaction in the future. That doesn't just apply to money, but to any goods and services. People would rather have them now than later in the near future, rather than the far future, other things being equal. So again, it isn't the money rate, the demand supply for money that you can loan, that's primarily determining the rate of interest. It's the rate of time preference. How much do you want to have? How much do you prefer getting goods now to getting them in the future? So what does all this have to do with the business cycle? Well, in the economy, there's some resources that are devoted to making consumption goods. For example, goods that people directly use. Now, other resources are devoted to making production goods. These are goods used to produce other goods. For example, we have steel factories. They're producing steel. Most people don't use steel directly, but steel is used to make other goods. So we have some resources are used to make consumption goods, others are used to make production goods. And within the production goods, we can have various stages of production. Now, Steve says, can we say production goods equals capital goods? Yes, that's a very good question. That's what we're talking about. Exactly, we're talking about capital goods. That's just another way of putting it. So we have then production goods. We can have various stages. We can have goods that are used to produce goods that are used to produce consumer goods. And we have goods that are used to produce those goods. And we can just keep having more and more stages in which the production goods are further and further separated from the consumption goods. We just have goods that are producing other goods, and we have goods, say, level one goods, and we have goods that are used to produce those goods, goods that are used to produce those goods, and so on. So we can keep adding more and more stages of production. So what determines what stage it is how many steps it takes to get to the consumer goods. Now, so we have this question, we have a certain number of resources in the economy. So what will determine how these where the goods are allocated, how many of the resources will be devoted to producing consumer goods, how many to the first stage production goods, second stage, so on. What determines how many stages there are and which resources go to which stages? Well, the answer is the rate of time preference. And remember, people prefer goods in the present to goods in the future, so they're not going to just keep increasing the number of stages indefinitely that keep going on and on, they're going to want to have consumption. The structure of production will be limited according to the rate of time preference. The higher the rate of time preference, then the more resources will be devoted to consumption goods rather than higher stage production goods. So now we can get back to expansion of bank credit. Now, as I mentioned, when the bank expands credit, this will lower the money rate of interest because the supply of loanable money available for loanable funds increase. So we can expect price to fall, supplies increase, price falls, the rate of interest goes down. So what happens if the rate of interest goes down? Well, then an entrepreneur will be able to invest in a higher stage of production than before. Because before the credit expansion, say the entrepreneur wouldn't be able to get the money for these projects because the interest rate would be determined by the rate of time preference. So he wouldn't be able to get at the existing interest rate. Say, you could say, well, how much am I going to make on my new project? It wouldn't be enough to justify the investment. But if the rate of interest he has to pay goes down, then he'll be able to invest more because it'll cost him less to get the money he needs for the expansion. Now we got the big problem. I like big problems as long as they're not problems for me. Remember, it's basically the Austrian view. The rate of interest is fundamentally determined by the rate of time preference, not by the supply and demand of loanable funds. So rate of interest has gone down, money rate of interest has gone down because the supply of money has increased. But that isn't the fundamental determinant of a rate of interest. So what's going to happen after the credit expansion stops? Then the rate of interest will go up again because we're assuming that people's time preference remains the same. People's time preference hasn't become less. Time preference remains the same. It's just we've had a temporary fall in the rate of interest because there's been an increase in the supply of money. So then what happens then? Well, then the businesses that expanded will no longer be able to get money to continue their activity. And those businesses will collapse because they were able to get the money before because, remember, the rate of interest has gone down. But now the rate of interest goes back up, so the businesses won't be able to continue. And resources need to be shifted to lower stage of production to correspond with the rate of time preference. What's happened, remember, the credit expansion has led entrepreneurs to think there's room to increase the number of stages of production, but they could do that only if the rate of time preference, I mean, they could do that and stay in business only if the rate of time preference had shifted. If the rate of time preference shifted, that means people want to shift resources to higher stages of production. But they don't. The rate of time preference hasn't shifted. So then resources need to be shifted back to lower stages of production. And this collapse and resource transfer is the depression. That's when the boom caused by credit expansion comes to an end and resources are transferred to the way that corresponds to the rate of time preference. And in the Austrian view, it's desirable that resource transfer not be impeded, because that's just what the what's involved in getting the structure production to correspond to people's rate of time preference. And so the boom is a distortion in the economy because it's led business people to think that people want to shift more resources to higher stage of production, but in fact they don't, and it's a depression that enables the economy to go back to the distribution of the stage of production that corresponds to the rate of time preference. So I think I'll stop now. We now have a question. Now, people, of course, can ask whatever questions you like, but I'd rather, maybe because I don't know the answer to these, I'd rather people not ask about particular details of current money crank schemes. I'm not really familiar with those, and I have to look at them to be able to analyze them in detail if I could, if I looked at them. But I'm not really familiar with the Ellen Brown, other people of that kind. So if you need answers to those, I'm not going to be able to be of too much help to you. Oh, Malcolm, that was just an exchange between Kevin and I. Now, there's a comment I'm tempted to make about that sentence, but I'd better not. And it's not that you shouldn't have such an exchange, but I'm tempted to make Jack says, would you advocate 100% reserve banking for monetary standards? Yes, I mean, that's kind of the Rothbardian point of view on the matter, that then we don't have any problems of this kind of business. Well, I will just make my one comment. I hope you'll forgive me for this. I'm a very old man. I'm used to I like certain words you should never say between someone and I. Between, remember, it takes the objective case, so between Kevin and me. I've heard people say between he and I. I mean, if I had a gun, I would have started shooting, but that's one thing. You know, I think it's important to preserve our correct usage. I hope you don't mind my saying it. Now, Jack says he heard some Austrians don't think 100% banking is necessary. Yes, there are some. Larry White is one. Steve Horowitz. Roger Garrison. There are certainly people who favor so-called free banking, but that they don't believe in and central banking, but they don't favor 100% reserves. But I'm Rothbardian. Oh, well, thank you, Malcolm. I hope you don't mind. I hear people say that all the time. Jackson, could you explain why they feel that way, considering fractional reserves still cause boom? Well, they think that as long as you don't have a central bank, then if it wouldn't be the case that you'd have really much problem, much in the way of problem, because if a bank just expanded a lot, then clients from other banks would go and try to cash in the money, and they go out of business. But where the Rothbardians differ from that group is they seem to accept the point that if the economy becomes more productive, or at least in certain other circumstances, you need an increase in the quantity of money. So that's why they favor fractional reserves. They say, well, sometimes you have to have increase in quantity of money to because people want to hold more money. And remember, the view I was giving in the lecture is that the purchasing power of money will adjust even given the same amount of money. It doesn't matter what the amount of money is. Any amount of money will do the job. Now, what they say in response to that, they know all the argument. They say, well, but look, it's not, it's true eventually purchasing power of money will increase if people demand more money, but it doesn't increase fast enough. So that's why you need more units of money. There's sometimes difficulties in adjusting purchasing power fast enough, but I don't think they've given a good criterion for what's the correct amount, the speed at which purchasing power should adjust. I don't think they come up with good arguments that the market doesn't do it fast enough. It may be true that it's harder to have changes in purchasing power than other sorts of price adjustments, but it doesn't follow from that that there's something that the market rate of adjusting supply of purchasing power is too slow. Helen says credit cards also have the effect of expanding the money supply. Well, that would be more, I think, going, I'd have to check on that. That's a very good question. That would be something like increasing the amount of debt. I don't think it would directly expand the money supply, but I mean, it might have. I'd have to check that to be sure. That would just be people increasing their purchases, but I don't think it would follow that the supply of money would go up. I mean, maybe, I suppose you could define supply. It would really depend on how you define the supply of money. I mean, it would just be, I think, I'd be inclined to think, again, I have to look this up, it would be largely a question how you define the supply of money. So there wouldn't really be a good answer to that. In some definitions of money supply, that would be an increase in supply of money. Now, Malcolm, has anyone written how Mises seminar or other seminars were conducted, such as Ayn Rand? Very interested in dynamic protocols, how that affects flow. Well, I think there are people who have given recollections of Mises seminar. He would give a lecture and then ask for questions. Sometimes students, such as Rothbard and others, would present papers that would be discussed by the group. It's kind of a standard seminar format. I don't think he had anything that was really unusual as far as seminars went. Now, Ayn Rand, I don't think, gave lectures. I don't think she gave seminars. Okay. Oh, now Malcolm said, Joseph Lerner says it has a one-time effect. People switched it. Yes, that's well. I mean, Joe knows this stuff a great deal better than I do. So there could be an effect in people switching to credit cards versus using cash. That's interesting. But I don't know the details on that. Now, Leslie said, if money supply would decrease, will we get a boom misallocation of investment and resource for consumer goods and lower stage production goods? Wouldn't there be reverse Keynesian effects? People whose money holdings were decreased relatively would be better off. See what happens there if the supply, if the government just takes away money. You could certainly have different effects on different people, but you wouldn't have a reverse. Let's see. So you'd have the money supply is, imagine the banks, let's say the banks just stop lending money, then that wouldn't cause that. Then all you'd have is that decreased supply of money. Then you'd have, you wouldn't have a shift to consumer goods. It would just be that certain businesses would collapse, but they would be really, they could be really profitable if there were, say, let me phrase this a little better, is all you would have there would be certain businesses would fail, but you wouldn't have any movement toward consumer goods. It would just be that certain businesses that were able to get money wouldn't be able to get the money anymore. And if you, I think you could have effects where people had the money taken away would be, so let's say they had money taken away, then those prices would go down on goods they bought, and then others would be better off because they'd be able to buy the goods at lower prices. But it very rarely happens that the supply of money just decreases in that way, as opposed to decreasing purchasing power brought about by increase in production. You see, so you wouldn't have a reverse boom. Now that I was listening to a lecture by Rothbard discussing exchange and means, discussing means, call it Rothbard or Schmollerite, predisagreeing about monopoly theory. I'm trying to understand intellectual history and nuance. There's a difference between means and Rothbard. Has anyone written about all the ways Rothbard differed from means? Could you summarize? Thanks. Well, I don't think anyone's written in detail. I mean, there were minor points of difference, such as this one on monopoly, and but I don't think there are really a whole lot in economic theory. There are differences in political theory, philosophy, but in economic theory, there were, I don't think there were that substantial difference. But it would be an interesting question to go into them in detail. Now, Helen says the CC company did checks be deposited in bank account. Mark can use them to pay the CC loan continuous cycle for a long time. It's been longer, of course, but in the short term, it looks more prosperous. This must affect you can use the money supply definition. So the correct, well, I mean, then you'd have the question of where does the credit company would get a check from, would have its money, would give their checks would be drawn on certain banks. I mean, this would just be a variation, I think, on regular bank credit expansion. It would just be another form of bank credit expansion, which the credit card companies would be an intermediary in the process. It wouldn't fundamentally change the analysis, I don't think. Now, Jack says speculation doesn't have to happen with credit or expansion, but misallocation of resources will. Expansion of credit, instead of credit misallocation. Well, I think that's right. I mean, depending on what you meant by speculation, I mean, it wouldn't have to be speculation on stocks. That's certainly right. Well, here's another question here. Let's see, this looks like a long one. Malcolm, has it read, was precise great matter of classical economists, they looked for second consequences. They were concerned with the effects of a given economic policy or development in the long run on the whole community. It was also their defect that in taking a long view and the broad view, they sometimes neglect to take also the short view and the narrow view. They were too often inclined to minimize, forget altogether, the immediate effects of developments on special groups. Question, is there an essay, a book that speaks about what the classical economists got right or wrong? The also effects on society, what they got wrong, or the, i.e. what were the effects of society, political economics, and the classical economists were dismissed? Well, that's an excellent question. I don't know specifically anyone who's written on that. I mean, of course, that was a point Keynes made. He said, well, famous thing, in the long run, we're all dead. But he accused the classical economists of not taking account of the short run at all. But Mises has a good passage on that in Human Action where he says, look, it isn't that we should just consider the long run, it's just we should be aware of both the long run and short run consequences and not pretend that the long run consequences don't exist. So what he was emphasizing was, we need to take account, and has it also, we have to take account of all the consequences of what we're doing. So it isn't that what Hazlitt is stressing in the passage you make is, look, it isn't only the long run that matters. What would be an example? I'm supposing somebody said, well, we don't really have to be concerned with people being shift in the economy that drive people out of work, because eventually labor will be able to shift into new employment. I think that's quite true, but it doesn't follow that they'll be able to make these shifts instantaneously. So there is a cost to people in shifts of the economy that needs to be borne in mind. It doesn't lead to government intervention, but it is something we shouldn't assume that because adjustments will take place, that we really the process doesn't involve any difficulties. Now, Kevin said, what are the lectures I'm giving at Mises University this year? Oh, well, now the first one I think I'm giving 4 lectures. I think the first one I have to give is the one that's worrying me, because that's when I have to give to the whole group the introduction to praxeology. Maybe I'll just say I'd like you to meet praxeology and leave it at that, or have a hand. I threatened to have a hand puppet when I'm giving my lecture, and I call it Praxeology Pete, but I chickened out. I never did that. Okay, so I give that one. Then I have one, I think, I have one on theory and history, I think, economic reasoning, everyday what is the other one? They're on the schedule. I don't even remember what the other one is. But it's quite similar to the ones I give in my courses. Now, Arthur, are we having final lecture next week or the week after? You prefer the week after due to virtual Mises. Well, I think they've scheduled me for actually next week. They've scheduled me for Tuesday, July 23rd, but it won't be conflict with the virtual Mises because it'll be at a different time. But of course, otherwise you can just listen to it afterwards. But I think they've had me, I'm sorry, but I think they told me it would be July 23rd. And now says the directory of those who are in the PT would mean to Rothbard is supervised. Well, Mises didn't have to, there are a few students who got their PhD with Mises. There aren't very many of them. Fritz Machloop, Hans Senholz, there was another, George Reisman, Ed Facey, I think. But there aren't very many. Now, Rothbard would be a very short directory. Rothbard didn't have any PhD students. He never taught in a graduate school with a PhD program. he had MA students, but not PhD. Yes, I can't believe it. Mises U is coming up next week. Now, I remember one time I may have mentioned this story. I was sitting with some of the students one of the lunches or dinners, and one of them said, "Oh, this is my second time at Mises U." And then another one said, "Oh, I've been here. This is my third time." And then I said, "Well, this is my 27th time." Now, I think Mao said, I think Bob Murray said, from other you were able to have Rothbard supervised. I didn't know that. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. I mean, it may well be people could get, I don't think he had any PhD students. I mean, Murphy said Robert Bradley. Well, that I'd have to look into. I don't know anything about that. I mean, now it's possible, of course, you have to make sure you can have someone, very often you can have someone from outside the university on your PhD committee, but I mean, actually having them as the chairman would be unusual. But that's not to say what Bob said was false. Another was on his quick life. He was asking who was a student who got his PhD with Rothbard. Oh, I wouldn't have passed that quiz. You know, when I just wanted, you forgive me, one of my funny stories, at least I think they're fun. You know, I was giving that point on grammar in the lecture. I remember there was one classics professor at University of Illinois I used to know a little bit, who was extremely particular about questions of usage. He would answer the phone in this way, say, 5660, say, Professor Oliver, this is he. I'll never forget that. Is there anybody else here? Now, what is Bob Murphy's course on? Is this on energy economics? Well, it sounds like it would be a very good course. Are you getting into global warming and all that sort of thing? Yes, too tired to take the energy course. Yes, I used to say, well, I want to take a memory course. I'm going to take a memory course, but I forgot. Yes, find it very energizing. Now I said, do you know what your next course will be? No, I think Danny Sanchez would be the one to ask about that, but they haven't told me yet. I know Bob Murphy, I think he worked for a while. He was working for Bradley. I don't know. I don't think he is now, though, but he was at one time. Now, Jackson, what's your favorite subject to teach? Well, I mean, I like whatever they give me is all right. You know, I like I like ones where I can give refutations of things like political theory or, you know, any ones like philosophy ones I like. I know a little bit about that. But whatever they want me to do is all right. I think they just kind of use me. They use me to fill in where they think they have something they want, a subject that they think I can kind of work it up. They can kind of use me as needed. What would I like to do? Well, I like to give one on people I've known, but that would be too controversial. Are you the only one taught Broken Camp? As far as I know, yes, I think they just introduced the course this time. I mean, the topics have come up, I'm sure, in other people's courses, but under this particular name. Now, Malfoy, could you speak of the dynamics why Kingsley took over classical liberalism? Was classical liberalism viewed as a threat to the powers that be? Well, I think it was more that classical liberalism really didn't give much scope for those who favored government intervention. So Keynesianism was really justifying policies they wanted to undertake. People say at the time of the Depression said, well, we want the government to do something, so they needed some ideology by which I think the government would do something. They weren't getting it from classical liberalism. I think that Keynesianism is more in line with what's in the interests of more of the elite groups who want to control things. I think it's classical liberalism would be a threat to them in that there wouldn't be any role for them. So it's more that I think it's more of an attraction of Keynesianism rather than classical liberalism as a threat. It just supported the other views that were more in line with what they wanted. Oh, I'm amazed. No one telephoned during my lecture today. Wonder what I did right. Did I pay the bill? Well, that reminds me. That reminds me of a story. Like most things, there was a man came home from work, and his little boy, about 10 years old, said to him, while you were out, there was a man knocking at the door asking for you. So the father got very nervous, said, did he have a bill? The little boy said, no, just an ordinary nose like you. Yes. Well, I guess we're out of time now, so I hope for those of you who can tune in next week. I think they shifted it to Tuesday, I think, for next week, which should be at Mises U. I hope I'll see you there. Thank you, Jack. Hope to see you all next week. Thanks, everybody. Have a safe trip. Yes, I'm not going to San Francisco for it. I'm Asiana Airlines. Okay, thanks, everybody.